Images of police in tactical gear at protests like those seen in Ferguson, Missouri, sparked a debate about whether such gear creates more negative outcomes. However, a study conducted by researchers from UT's Boyd Center for Business and Economic Research indicates that isn't necessarily the case. I spoke to Matt Harris, one of the authors of the paper, about their findings. What is the 1033 program? When did it begin, and what was its original purpose?
So the 1033 program was authorized as part of the National Defense Authorization Act of 1997. And the 1033 program permits the Department of Defense, and specifically the Defense Logistics Agency, to transfer decommissioned military equipment to originally state and federal agencies, but also after 97, local law enforcement agencies, to enhance drug interdiction capabilities primarily.
Is the increase in gear going to law enforcement correlated with the war in the Middle East, and in what way?
Great question. So if you look at the amount of equipment transferred through the 1033 program, there's a relatively small number of items transferred up until 2006. And then in 2006, I believe the Army and the Marine Corps changed their standard issue infantry rifle from the M16 to the M4 carbine. And so you see a large release of assault rifles through this program in 2006. And then as the drawdown from Iraq and Afghanistan commenced in 2009, 2010, you start to see much larger numbers of items being transferred at that time.
Local police have obviously garnered the most visibility from using the 1033 program, but what other agencies are able to acquire tactical items?
State law enforcement, DEA, Homeland Security. And the primary customer, if you will, was the term that that DLA used, was other military units. And so even if one military unit no longer has use for a set of items, and they will transfer those items to DLA, and DLA has sort of an order that they go through. And one is, does any other unit have a use for this? Then the federal agencies have the opportunity to make a claim. And then state and local police have an opportunity to make a claim. And then failing on that, it's typically disposed of.
And explain where the DLA is.
Sorry, the DLA is the Defense Logistics Agency. And so they are a subset of DOD, Department of Defense, and they are in essence the supply chain function for the Department of Defense, as I understand it. And specifically the program that oversees 1033 is DLA, Defense Logistics Agency Disposition Services, which is another subset under Defense Logistics.
Explain how you compensated for potential underreporting of citizen complaints. For example, if a better armed police force acts more aggressive, citizens may be too intimidated to complain.
So we control for unobserved heterogeneity, period, in police departments. And so we have there's statistical tools that will enable you to kind of wash out sort of permanent differences in any groups that you're observing. And so by using these fixed effects, we can take the difference within these groups. But, you know, really because our result is not about the correlation, that our work is trying to get to the causal effects, then what our work is about is does increased acquisition of these items cause changes in behavior versus is increased acquisitions of these items associated with changes in behavior.
It's important to remind people that correlation does not mean causation. It's
right.
It's something you see a lot in Facebook arguments, and people try to explain that you know, these are two separate things.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are studying one very specific thing. Let's talk about data sets. What is lacking in crime statistics today?
That's a great question. So there's lots of publicly available data on crimes reported, on cases closed, on arrests that are based on crime types that are not reported. For example, drug possession and drug sales, that sort of thing. For the purpose of answering these questions, you know, as economists, we think of things in cost-benefit terms. And so when we were we took an objective and a neutral approach in thinking about the causal effects of this program. We wanted to understand in what cases was it doing good, but we also wanted to speak to concerns about, do these items have adverse causal effects. And we found it difficult to find data, systematic data, on what you would consider to be bad outcomes. And so the our first thought was we wanted to look at complaints. Does acquisition of these items lead to an increase in complaints against police, which seemed like a reasonable measure of bad outcomes, if there is one? And we were not able to find, it was very costly for us to find, I should say, complaint data. We found we hand collected what we could from annual reports, but annual reports are typically only produced by the larger departments. And we put in some FOIA requests, and some of the data that we got was great, and some of the data that we got was not systematic. It was a collection of reports, but there was, in some cases, it was difficult to tell exactly what we were saying.
You mentioned in the study, we don't find evidence that acquiring tactical items of any type leads to increases in offender deaths at the extensive or intensive margin. Where did the perception that this gear could lead to more offender deaths come from?
I can't tell you exactly where the perception came from. That's not what I do, and that's not my area of expertise. So let me answer the question a different way.
Sure.
We, like everybody else, were struck by the images that we saw in Ferguson, where you had very heavily armed police and very angry, mostly unarmed protesters. And as social scientists, we came into work and said, okay, has anybody done a rigorous data-driven analysis of what these items, of what this actually does? Is this doing any good? Is this doing any bad? And having found that no, there was a nice, there was a book out by Radley Balco that sort of documented, anecdotes of the increased uptake of this equipment, but nobody had done any analysis about what these items were actually doing. And so our work is not about that perception necessarily, but just wanting to understand, wanting to make a contribution that, particularly as economists and as members of the Boyd Center for Business and Economic Research, as we learned that these items were coming in part and parcel from the federal government, that became a very relevant policy question. And so I can't speak to the origins of the perception, but our work was about, independent of that perception, what are these things actually doing? What effects are they really having?
And what types of gear, to specify, what types of gear are we talking about enforcement agencies are receiving?
So most of the items that law enforcement agencies receive are relatively uncontroversial. So you have ice chests, jackets, pants, car parts, first aid kits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then among the tactical items, among the restricted items, you have pistols, assault rifles, small caliber weapons, optics, so day scopes, night scopes. You have helicopters, utility trucks, fixed wing aircraft as well. Also, in some cases, grenade launchers and armored vehicles, wheeled and tracked.
You also say that you have some concerns about the validity of specification for these particular outcomes, referring to the deterrent effects. So what does that mean exactly?
So when you run our particular empirical methods, the instrumental variables approach, you're going to get some you get statistics that come out of that. And there's tests to tell you that is what you're doing valid, or are these particular numbers, should you be suspicious of them? And most of the statistics as it relates to the deterrent effects told us that there was reason to be somewhat suspicious of these figures. But beyond that, you would expect that if there was going to be a deterrent effect, that these items might deter some types of criminal activity, but perhaps not others. And the results that we got were a bit scattered. There wasn't the ordering that you would expect there to be if it was a clear sort of intuitive deterrent story. So most of that reservation on our part comes from the non-intuitive order and scope of some of the findings in that particular set.
Something that seems to be suggested here is that the tactical gear is essentially free, and that the local enforcement agencies, they can spend their money on other things instead of things like protective gear for officers. Is that what you observed?
So we don't observe what departments spend their money on. in great detail. There are some publicly available data about county budgets, about municipal budgets, and in those budgets include law enforcement. But we don't observe specifically how departments are spending their money at the line item.
Your study is saying that the 1033 program yielded not only fewer citizen complaints and didn't increase aggressiveness, but increased officer safety and public safety by how much?
So the results in this paper indicate that a 1% increase in the number of tactical items acquired through this program lead to a 0.28% decrease in complaints against officers. The results on assaults on officers are much smaller, but were still statistically significant, meaning that with 95% probability, we see there's some effect, but it's not very large.
Okay. Now, in the end, you're not necessarily saying it's good policy to saturate local law enforcement with military hardware.
That's right. And you know, the main reason is that, well, there's a few reasons, but the two that I think are most important are that these results are true on average, but they don't necessarily mean that these results are true in all places. And so it is, our results indicate that these items are doing some good in some places, but perhaps they're doing not so good in other places. So the fact that our results are an average, and just an average, is one of the main limitations of what we do. But you know, the main takeaway, I think, in my mind, is that there seems to be a lot of conversation about, you know, public safety and relationships with the populace. And where results are helpful, I think, is that if you want to improve public safety outcomes, you know, focus on the people. Police militarization, if you want to call it that, is not what our study's about, because police militarization is, you know, a function of a lot of things, including leadership, culture, hiring practices, training practices, other things that I haven't thought of, and then finally the stuff. And our work is only about the stuff. And so while the stuff makes for a striking image, I think the main takeaway from our work is not that more of these things are necessarily needed everywhere, but if you want to improve things, then focus on the human components.
What questions would you like to see answered in the future?
So the other call that we made in the end of our paper is for greater transparency. And, you know, we were curious about, you know, about operational practices. Does increased use of this equipment lead to, a greater number of SWAT deployments? We believe that public safety is a public service provided for the public, and that good data on both the good outcomes and the unfortunate outcomes and the result of the provision of that public safety should be public. So we believe the public deserve better data, because better data helps us do better research and hopefully shape better policy. And we're in the data business. And so we would like to see there be better data and better transparency on all fronts. And hopefully that can not only help us do better relations, but get us away from the emotional place that sort of, you know, that makes this such a hot button, and be able to talk more descriptively and objectively about what is.
Well, Matt Harris, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.